This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
We're now going to sort of move on to panel discussion. I don't know if we need to move. Do we need to move the microphone? No? Okay, fine. Just wanted to check. So I just want to introduce two other panel members because we're going to sort of look at, you know, moving forward, how do we do sort of like integrated services? Heather Richardson, who is the clinical lead for Help the Hospices, will sort of be talking very much from the hospice perspective. And Steve Barnard, who heads the clinical governance for the Ambulance Trust up in Northwest. So really what I'm just going to do is ask both of them to sort of say a few words about, from their perspective, around service integration, and then give Lorna and Eve opportunities. But also feel free to chip in, because I think this is an opportunity to see how, you know, share what you're doing as well. So, Heather, can I ask you to...
Shall I start?
Yes, please, thank you.
Okay, Claire asked me if I'd just speak literally for 5 minutes about how hospices are part of an integrated way of delivering end-of-life care. So literally in a few minutes, my plug is keep us involved, I think. And I have many hospice colleagues in the audience. As you said, they'll either challenge me or support me, but also they'll talk to you further. So if you'd like to know more about what we do at the end, do seek them out. Why should we be involved? I guess the big message for me is end-of-life care is complex. More positively, it's really on the agenda. Steve Jobs' death last week was fascinating in terms of how much interest it has promoted. Dying Matters clearly is doing a job. And for the first time ever, I feel that actually people do genuinely believe that death is a responsibility for us all, and that's good news. But as Tom said today, we've got to really cooperate to get the best for our patients, their families, and their carers. So what have hospices got to offer to that picture? I guess fundamentally, I think hospices are a good thing, but I would say that. I work in one, and I support them nationally. We've got history, as my kids would say, and we're derived from the passion and the commitment of communities. All the hospices that I've worked in have evolved from a single person's desire to improve end-of-life care, where they've then galvanised communities and individuals who can help. And so we are community participation in practice. And I think a lot of what Dying Matters is doing and Compassionate Communities doing is trying to get back to that. So we've a history that we can learn from. And we've expertise in end-of-life care, particularly the specialist side of it. And I suppose most importantly, we get it right. Patient experience of end-of-life care in hospices is usually very good. And that's great for the person who's dying. It's important for the person who's dying. But it's also really important for the people who are left behind. Having said that, hospices don't get everything right with that clearly. And very often we've worked in isolation and we're not integrated as part of the wider community of people engaged in end-of-life care. We've often been seen as exclusive. We certainly don't look after everybody who is dying. And we don't actually manage to reach people who could benefit from our care. So there are issues about accessibility. And so that's why I'm here, because actually we've got something to offer, but we've got something to learn as well, and to gain from being part of a wider community. Integration's important then, and I think if we work together, hospices can really help achieve elements of the end-of-life care strategy, and I could go into that, but I haven't time now, but certainly around talking about dying, around achieving the end-of-life care pathway, hospices have a huge amount to offer to that. We could help shape end-of-life care services in the future. We know a lot about local need. We know a lot about gaps in provision, and we'd like to work with commissioners and other planners to do that. We could play a central role in coordinating and delivering services, but we would want to do that in partnership, certainly in the hospice that I work in. And I think the other thing that hospices could do would be about being part of an intelligence network, a research network, that takes forward a lot of the ideas that need properly evidence basing in order to do well. So how can you help us be involved, either as a commissioner, a planner, or as another provider of end-of-life care? Please make sure that we're at any discussion about end-of-life care. And it's not to say that we want to dominate it or that we know the answers, but we'd like to be part of the solution. And articulate clearly what you think we can do to help. I think often hospices don't actually know what they could do in the wider arena, and if they do, they don't have the chance to do it. Help us look critically at what we do best and less well, and support us to continue to provide it. And I just wanted to finish by giving two very quick examples of work that Help the Hospices has been doing with the National End of Life Care Programme, which I think at a national level shows you what we could all be doing together. And the first is a really nice piece of work that the End of Life Care Programme's leading on, where it's looking at critical success factors that make a difference to enabling people to die at home if that's what they want. And we've been able to encourage hospice chief executives to become involved in discussions about what those critical success factors are locally, really augmenting those conversations, but also an opportunity for hospices to learn about the perspectives of others. So I've been really pleased with that. And the other bit of work that I've been doing with Claire's team is about improving care in hospitals by giving hospital staff an opportunity to learn from hospice care workers. And again, I think that's going to be a really good collaborative piece of work and a good example nationally of what we could be doing locally. Thanks, Claire.
Thank you. Steve, would you like to, from your perspective?
Good afternoon. I have to say, just in terms of the national strategy, I mean, one of the sort of most positive aspects of that was that the ambulance service was actually included in that. Kind of from the outset, which is coming from an ambulance service background, that's quite a novelty. Normally, national strategies, we're kind of an afterthought. So, and that's continued as well through the sort of development of the quality markers and the likes. I just thought it would be useful to start perhaps by sort of considering the role of ambulance services in relation to end-of-life care. And I think from my experience, we're quite often thought about in sort of having two main roles, and one is about the sort of discharge from hospital for dying patients, and also for responding to 999 calls when patients are actually dying. But actually, if you think about the 12-month sort of period prior to when death is expected and the care planning that goes with that, we actually have a lot more kind of frequent contact with these patients. And that can be from the likes of routine transport services for people attending the likes of outpatients appointments, and also for general 999 calls where people, say, just become more symptomatic. There's a general deterioration. They may actually be what we sort of class as frequent callers because of the condition that they have, and they have sort of frequent episodes. And quite often as well, it's when family or other carers are struggling to cope and they've no other sort of point of contact, or they're not sure what services to call, or services simply might not be available, particularly out of hours, and they phone for us. And quite often as well, through that period, we get a number of calls for patients where they may simply have had a fall. It may not actually be related necessarily to the condition, it just may be something else. And we routinely go out and we will take these people to hospital. And as we know, it can be quite difficult to get these people back out of hospital as well. So that's ambulance services. So, I mean, how do we look at becoming more integrated? Well, there's a number of issues, really. And the first one is that ambulance services are fairly unique, I suppose, in compared to other healthcare providers in end-of-life care. In most occasions, we sort of go in blind to people and with no prior knowledge or sort of history of that person, of the family, of the carers. We don't know who else has been involved in the care. We don't know what's been said by the GP. We don't know what's been agreed. And we also don't know what they know, and we don't know what their expectations are. And quite often, we have to figure all this out in a very short period of time. It could be 2 o'clock in the morning. And they're working autonomously as well. So it's a real challenge in that respect. And we often have limited sort of access to information as well, certainly in a sort of timely fashion. And things like when say, a patient actually is dying, how do we know there's a do not attempt resuscitation directive there, for example? And quite often we end up in very difficult situations. Another factor as well is that we are very large organisations now, and we have a sort of large geographical spread. And because of that, we cut across a huge number of different organisations and different care settings. And in the Northwest, we've got over in excess of 60 different other sort of provider organisations that we have to sort of try and interact with. And it's already been mentioned today, but in the main, all these organisations, although they're all trying to do the same thing, they've all got slightly different ways of getting there through different policies, different systems, as Lorna said, through slightly different documents. And that makes it difficult for us as services to develop our own policy and systems, but it also makes it incredibly difficult for the ambulance staffers because they don't just work in one area. They cut across these boundaries on a daily basis and they can come across unfamiliar documents and the like. So it is a challenge for us. So in terms of how we actually sort of improve things, what are the enablers? I think the key thing really for us is we need to be involved more. We need to be involved at a much earlier stage in the development of services and in the development of local policy. And we need to be sort of seen as an integral part of the care planning and the pathways. I think for me, information systems are key. In terms of having sort of robust integrated ones, where if we can find out about just the existence of a care plan document, we can put alerts on our system so that we can alert crews when they then attend those addresses, just to prompt them to look for a care plan, just simply to say end of life care plan at this address. And it changes the whole way that they then approach that person, and the way that they then deal and the way that they think about them. And we can also do a lot more education in terms of making the staff understand the importance of the care planning and changing the culture almost of treating transport to hospital to one about considering other pathways and keeping them in the home or in the community. There also needs to be more consistency and sort of coherence with policies and procedures and probably more need for sort of pan-organisational policies, particularly in relation to, DNA CPRs. And also looking at the care planning and make sure that it actually follows and works for the patient across all those different care settings. And it doesn't just stop when they get home and then it waits on the GP having to come out and review that and it's a weekend and all the other sort of different sort of factors. And access to community services as well, certainly for us, 24/7, so that if we do go out to patients, well, there might be a plan that says they actually want to stay at home. They might have care needs that we can't just simply leave them, and we need to have referral pathways so that we know somebody can respond within an hour, 2 hours, to sort of pick up on that, really. And I think to support all that, there needs to be sort of greater strategic partnership working, to develop hopefully sort of single solutions as well across sort of larger areas to prevent a lot of the sort of duplication of effort and B, what then causes sort of confusion at a sort of patient level. And obviously the commissioning as well needs to kind of encourage and support that joint approach as well. I think on a positive note, what we have done recently with the End of Life Care Programme is got all the ambulance services together to produce a Routes to Success document. Which will hopefully tell the ambulance services what sort of developments need to happen, but also help educate other services on how they can work better with the ambulance services to develop things. Thank you.
Well, we've heard a few views from the panel. I'm very conscious, I would have said, there's some quite large groups missing from the panel as well. I'd welcome sort of any sort of ideas from social care colleagues, housing colleagues and others in the audience around how we can really move towards integration. So I don't know, is there anybody who would like to contribute to the discussion? Thank you.
Do I introduce myself again?
Yes, please.
Yeah, Andrew Makin, registered nurse.
Can you stand up? Sorry, I don't mean to be bossy.
Like straightening out a paperclip. Andrew Makin, Registered Nursing Home Association. I wonder, Heather, if you'd repeat everything that you said a few minutes ago, substituting the word nursing home for hospice. Things have changed a lot in the last 10 years or so I've been involved in end-of-life care work. But it still seems to me that our sector has its nose pressed to the glass, and there's so much more we could do if we were asked. I have this image of commissioners, folks like you, I think, developing a new service model, a nice, shiny new model, looking round saying, who can we get to deliver this new service? Well, you're a nursing home, so we know what you do. Where else can we go to get this service delivered? Instead of saying, are you interested? Hey, is this something with the right support and training that you could be involved with, that you could do? So I would add to your plea, Heather, keep our sector in mind, keep us involved. A lot of people less than 20 miles away at the nearest hospice, or 30 miles the nearest DGH, metaphorically, round the corner, there's a nursing home that can deliver some of this service.
Thank you. Any comments from anybody else? Oh, lady over here.
Juliette Millard, Nursing and Health Professions Advisor for Leonard Cheshire Disability. Very much agree with what Andrew has just said. Obviously, our service user group is slightly different from care of the elderly. We take people from 18 onwards, and we also have a children's service as well. My job is a national one, and I think I can honestly say that in terms of our own services, we have some care homes and care homes with nursing that can have really achieved great things with end-of-life care in specific areas of the country, and that is down to joint working. And there are other care homes with nursing within Leonard Cheshire Disability that would really love to achieve that too, and they can't because there isn't the joint working. And I think that's really the point I need to make. It links with what was said first thing this morning. It's so patchy and it needs to improve across the whole country.
Thank you. Any of our social care colleagues? I know they're probably sat at the back.
Hi, I'm Trish Winnell from Bromley Borough. We have end-of-life care strategy underway with our PCT and our hospices, and carers Bromley are also involved in that, which is all good. And I was sitting thinking about the things we're doing, a lot of this already, which felt good. And I was sitting there congratulating myself about that and thinking about my colleagues' efforts in making that happen. But I think one thing that really struck me was we've got trusted assessor arrangements with our hospice so that the staff there can do the assessments for the social care input that's needed. But what's really made me think is about the 24/7 approach. Because although we've got out of hours, and our colleagues in out of hours as social workers, and they will put a care package in, there needs to be a strategy for that. So that's something that, in terms of what we can say, is the trusted assessor situation with the hospice is working really well, so I'd encourage people to go down that road if their local authorities will let them. But I'd say that from a learning for me is to look at our strategy in terms of the out-of-hours support.
Thank you. I always think on a personal level, out of hours for who? Because if you're actually providing that, you know, you're at the end of the care, out of hours doesn't mean anything to you, does it? Because it's your hours 24/7. So that's just a personal view that I think is something that I always want to challenge. Any other comments? Nobody else? Hey, Eve, would you like to say anything?
I think that, you know, the elephant in the room for many years has been we've had this statutory, you know, sort of responsibility to join up health and social care. We all want to do it. We need the right leadership at all levels to make it happen. You know, people at the end of the day want good support. You know, it's you know, whether it's in a nursing home, whether it's in a care home, in their sheltered accommodation, for basic things. Tom mentioned wheelchairs, you know, for the cats and the dogs. Now, I appreciate that some of this would be by the voluntary sector, because a lot of social care now is by the independent and the voluntary sector. So I think we've got to, again, going back to community leadership, and the leaders of all these great organisations need to come together for some common purpose, and I just think we've got to focus on that. Otherwise, I'm sort of thinking back all the roles I've had, and you know, we've talked all the time about integration. We all desperately believe in it. We've now got to really make it work.
Anyone else like to comment?
Thank you, Claire. I'd just like to respond to the lady about Leonard Cheshire. I think for us in Devon, there was a lot of learning from our Leonard Cheshire colleagues. When we went to talk to them, they said, don't think about advanced care planning as our last year of life thinking, because for some of us, it could be any time in our life. And actually, they were very keen to make sure the documentation that was developed in Devon was very user-friendly, that they'd had an influence in changing the language. And we'd started from a very clinical perspective. So I think that builds on what you're saying, really, and also what Anne was saying earlier on. You've got to engage with your community and your public to make things better. Thank you.
Does Anne want to come?
Thank you. Anne McFarlane. Can I address a question to the ambulance service? I just wondered what useful recognition is given to the Lions International canister approach for for end of life and any other situation in terms of care plans. Do you know this raises the issue for me. Lions International operate a system which can be picked up in chemists and hospitals and so on, which is a canister in which you put your care plan in the fridge. You put it in the canister, you stick it in the fridge, and you've got a little tick sticker on the door. So when the ambulance service arrives, they know exactly where to look for that information. And I just wondered how universally it's ever used by the ambulance service, whether it's a good idea really, and so on. Because if it is, you know, we really should be advertising it more. But if it's not really any use, then we don't.
Yeah, I mean, we are aware of it. I think the message in the bottle, isn't it? I think it's kind of commonly known as. And its uptake has been sort of patchy, but we have, certainly in the northwest, we've worked with some PCT areas to roll that out, where they've helped sort of promote the use of the sort of canisters, or you know, and people keep them in the fridges. But it's kind of reliant on a number of other people. I think from some of the other kind of pilot work we've done, it's probably not necessarily the best one that we've sort of felt that's out there, really, because the one element that we struggle with is being able to alert our staff to the presence of it, and it, normally that works better when you go through, say, like the GP practice or a district nursing team who can sort of, if you like, officially notify us of the existence of a care plan, and because we have real issues with keeping data on our systems against patients' addresses, and there's a real need to keep that current, and the sort of likes of the message in the bottle, well, we might be told that there's one there when it's no longer there or no longer needed. It's difficult to get that updated in the system, whereas if it sits with other health professionals, it's more reliable.
I think there was one question at the back. Is somebody with a hand up over here? They've changed their mind. Okay. All right, well, actually, we're sort of nearly at time. Anyway, it's 1 o'clock for lunch. I'd like to thank you for your questions. And really, I think the thing is, what we've heard today is that everybody, all the different organisations need to be around the table to actually develop and move services forward. And I think we can't over-communicate, so we just need to keep communicating and making sure we've got all the parties around the table to make this happen. So thank you very much. And can you come back for 2 o'clock, please? Thank you.